Welcome to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening this week. Sex, lies, and a complaint of indecent exposure. This has been the week that was in South Florida politics. First, it was Lake Worth State Senator Jeff Clemons resigning after an extramarital affair with a female lobbyist, and that became public. He was due to be the top Democrat in the state Senate in Tallahassee. Deasy Baez quit her office in the Florida House. She admitted to lying about living in the House district where she was elected to represent. She did not live there. And then the current Miami Beach Commissioner, Kristen Rosen Gonzalez, said a candidate she had supported for the commission exposed himself to her. Rafael Velasquez denies the claim. His campaign staff quit this week, and she has since filed a police complaint. So how much does a politician's personal behavior matter to you? That's first up here on the Florida Roundup this week. Pat C. in Boynton Beach said it matters greatly. If the regular Joe would have done this to him or her, they would have been fired and ruined. This should apply to those who are in the various positions of power in all levels of public service and government. They should be fired and punished to the fullest extent of the law. John in Miramar wrote us this: their personal behavior matters to me as a voter. People's behavior reveals their character, their values, and whether they are ready to lead anything. Lucy M. in West Palm Beach, her thoughts: their personal behavior does not matter to me as long as it can be kept separate from their political duties. But if we're found out that someone is holding their private behavior against them or threatening to leak it, this causing the politician to make a call under threat, then it matters greatly. Ideally, Lucy continues, they should not be doing anything that can cause actions like headlines like this, but no one is perfect. And then Carl from West Palm Beach sent us this note: they're all corrupt, and there's nothing I can do about it, so why talk about it or listen to it? All right, Carl, well, do you feel as dejected as Carl does about politicians, politics, and behavior? What's lost if voters, like Carl, turn cynical about civil service and about voting, for that matter? 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Add your voice to the conversation. You can also find us online on Twitter, at WLRN. Mark Caputo writes about all things Florida politics for Florida Politico. Dan Sweeney does much the same for the South Florida Sun Sentinel. Dan is with us via Skype. Mark here in studios downtown Miami. Mark, let's begin on the beach. The current city commissioner and the U.S. congressional candidate here, one and the same, Kristen Rosen Gonzalez, sent you a text. What did that text say, and what was the environment in which you received it?
Well, I wish I could. I knew I was going to get asked that question because I actually read it on air, which would probably do it more justice. But she said that the candidate she backed, Rafael Velasquez, had exposed himself to her, specifically when she was in a car with him. He opened his pants and showed his his goods.
And
she didn't want to see it.
She said, I was Harvey Weinstein'd, according to your story.
Right.
Yeah.
I buried the lead there. Yes. Right. She said I was Harvey Weinstein. And she described it in depth, you know, just a little kind of behind the scenes and reporting it. So on Sunday, when I called Rafael Velasquez and I said, hey, I said, how are you? Mark Caputo with Politico here. And he said, oh, it's good to talk to you. And I said, it's probably not going to be a good thing to talk to me. Just so you know, I apologize in advance for the story. But, you know, Kristen Rosen Gonzalez, the Miami Beach City Commissioner, had told me that you exposed yourself to her in an unwanted way. And I was just hoping to get comment from you. And he said, no, that didn't happen. Just in a very cool way.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know about you, but if someone accuses me of exposing myself, something I don't do and nor have ever done, I would say, like, is this a joke? Are you crazy? What are you talking about? Prank call? None of that. It was as if I had asked him, like, hey, I heard you bet that the Dolphins would win, but they lost. And
right.
You know what I mean?
It
was an odd response.
Yeah. And since then, other stories have surfaced.
Right. Well, there was another woman who is a PR professional in town who said that she was taking a picture with him and he grabbed her behind. And then there was another.
And she produced a text message conversation between herself and the candidate Velasquez. The text said, quote, very feminine and waiting for your photographer to shoot. You felt good, too. And then inserted the devil emoji in the text.
Right. And he then said that she was very sexy. And so when I asked him about this, Rafael Velasquez, being a married man, if he thought it was appropriate, and he's like, well, we're just friends. You know, my wife would probably not appreciate it if I were sending texts like that.
And meantime, his campaign staff has quit over this. But
the chair of the Democratic Party has told him he should drop out of the race.
But he has not.
Right. He has decided to stay with this. So, you know, as a result, it's there's some candidates who just decide to stay and get beaten up. They want to hang themselves like a pinata for the press to go at them. Well, Jeff Clements, who you referenced earlier, mm-hmm. was smart enough to quit the day that Politico Florida broke the story about right. him having a sexual affair with a lobbyist in Tallahassee.
Dan Sweeney, let's bring you in from the Sun Sentinel via Skype and talk about Senator Clements here. First admitted to this extramarital affair with a female lobbyist, as reported in Politico a week ago. It was only a few hours before he resigned. Give us a sense of that timeline and what's happened since. I think we may have lost Dan, but we'll connect with him momentarily.
I can pretend I'm Dan if you'd like.
No, that's okay, Mark. There's no pretending. You are Mark Caputo. There's no doubt about it.
Shucks.
Who you are, Caputo. Dan, are you with us now?
Yes.
There we go. Yeah, so walk us through the timeline a week ago with Senator Clements.
Right. So everything seemed to break pretty fast there last Friday. You know, Politico came out with the story that he had had an affair with a lobbyist then employed by Martin County, now employed by Broward County. That story came out Friday morning. And by Friday evening, Senator Clements had resigned.
Yeah.
Didn't even take the weekend to think it over, really. He was gone. And, you know, they're already moving ahead with trying to find somebody to replace him.
And so the fallout from this, Dan, is what? There's fallout certainly for Senator Clements personally, but also for the Democrats in Tallahassee.
Yeah, and for his constituents. You know, right now they're talking about a primary special election in late January and a general election in April, and that means that all these people that are in this central eastern Palm Beach County district will have no representation during the next legislative session.
Right. The legislative session begins in January. It will last for 2 months, assuming it gets out
right.
on time. And so if you don't have the general election until April, you're not going to have a state senator. And he was poised to be, the top Democratic senator in Tallahassee as well, a position obviously that comes with some leverage when talking about funding and financing and projects and all those other kinds of things.
Oh, sure. And you know, they're moving a lot quicker to fill that role. They'll be taking a vote. The Democrats in the Senate will be taking a vote on a new incoming Senate minority leader next week. Right now, it looks as though that will likely be Senator Audrey Gibson of Jacksonville. Mm-hmm. But yeah, all of those things you mentioned, the funding, the projects, all of that, Palm Beach County could have been poised for, and that all looks to have gone up in smoke with Clemens's Senate career.
Mark, since the news was broke about Senator Clemens and his resignation, two female senators, one Democrat, one Republican, one from South Florida, one from Southwest Florida, have come together to release a combined statement essentially asking other sexual harassment and assault victims working in the legislature to tell their stories. Why do you think they took that step?
Well, both of them had been survivors of sexual abuse or sexual assault. And the reality is, in Tallahassee, it is very difficult for a woman to complain that she has been harassed. It is an old boy network. It is controlled by white males. I'm not saying race by way of impugning any motives there, but the reality is that men are in charge in Tallahassee. They're in charge in the legislature. And it's very difficult for women in that environment to come forward. It's a small town, and the capital is an even smaller town, so to speak, within that town. And you don't want to risk losing your entire livelihood over something where you're probably not going to get a conviction. There's a slim chance that the lawmaker will even get drummed out of office.
A conviction of harassment or assault if it happens.
Right.
Yeah.
So there are very few incentives for a woman to come forward.
Dan, does the Senator Clemens story and the action that he took and what we've seen subsequent, does it begin to change that gender balance at all? I mean, give us a sense of what your sources have talked about in the past week as committee weeks come up and, of course, the session in just, what, about 6-8 weeks?
Well, I mean, I think immediately it does. I don't think it's any coincidence that Audrey Gibson is likely the next Senate minority leader. But as far as long term, you know, what Mark talked about is a systemic issue. You know, I don't know that necessarily changes just because of one scandal or even two or three. Yeah. You know, it's going to take a lot more women being elected and serving in the body before anything like that changes.
We asked our listeners, how much does a politician's personal behavior matter to you? It is a perennial question, certainly. Brian from Miami told us that politicians' behavior is no surprise to me, as they are representative of general society. If we live in a society in which stealing, lying, hypocrisy, and just downright poor behavior is acceptable, then why should we expect anything different from our politicians? Julio said it matters very much. If a politician is willing to lie to their families and loved ones and trusted ones, then it's only logical that someone will take advantage of said weakness. You can add your voice here to the conversation on the Florida Roundup at 800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN. Speaking with Dan Sweeney, political writer and reporter for the South Florida Sun-Sentinel, with us via Skype, Mark Caputo covering Florida politics for Politico. Let's talk about one other case, not of sex and power, but of a politician lying and admitting to lying. Daisy Baez quit her elected position this week. Mark, she admitted that she did not live in the district from which she was elected to represent. This came after the Miami Herald reported this summer that she was living in a neighboring district.
Daisy Laez, yes, I was a constituent of hers as well. And on October 13th, when a Florida House committee had moved forward with a rules complaint to examine her not living in her district, I remember talking to her at the time and saying, look, Daisy, if you did not live in your district, they're going to find out. And you've spoken to prosecutors about this as well. You probably should consider resigning. Oh, no, no, no. It's all a misunderstanding. These are lies about me. Well, we know who the real liar is. It's Daisy Baez. She's not fit for office. That's a fact.
And she resigned. She admitted to...
And she should stay out of office forever, although she's only banned for seeking office for a year.
Well, that's what I want to talk about here. She is ordered to take an ethics class. I believe there was a financial fine
$1,000
involved here. And then banned from political office, public office, for 1 year. So, Dan, is that a sentence that is justified by the crime of a politician lying under oath?
Well, you know, this rule that you know, legislators have to live in their district, this is one that's kind of regularly flouted in that, you know, legislators will have a house outside the district, then they'll get an apartment in the district, and they'll say, they'll get their mail sent there, and they'll register to vote there, and they'll say, well, now I live in the district, even though I have this house outside the district. That happens fairly regularly. I'm sure Caputo will back me up on that. But this was such a flagrant abuse of that rule, where she barely even made the attempt to get an apartment in the district, and people were all living there that weren't her.
Here's the thing, is to Dan's point, is that it is legal for a legislator to go through those workarounds that Dan described. You just need to be a legal elector of the district to which you have been elected. What she did is she just lied. She said, I'm renting a room from these people, and she wasn't.
Right, right. Had there been a paper trail, had there been a lease, had there been a FPL bill with an address on it inside the district from which she was elected, this would not have been an issue then,
right,
Mark?
Right. What really haunted Daisy Baez in the end is that she used some friends to say that she was living at their place. And then once this news got out, her friends got a call from the county and said, hey, look, you have a homestead exemption here, mm-hmm. and you're getting tax breaks as a result of it, but part of your home is now being used to produce income. You owe us money. So that started to unravel her lie.
To Dan Sweeney's point, Mark, talk to this idea that this kind of district swapping, so to speak, is not an atypical behavior, and certainly not an atypical behavior in what we've seen over the past, two or three years, as the districts have been redesigned via a court battle. So how, Mark, is this going to play itself out? Is the legislature and the ethics committee taking a new look at this, or was this such a flagrant...
The reality is, as Dan said, there's this corner cutting does happen. But in the end, the rule is the rule, and they're probably just going to stick with it. It's hard to change rules and laws in Tallahassee, and there's actually no statute about this. It's just in the Constitution.
Right.
But this is a pretty simple thing to follow, and it basically comes down to don't lie. You don't run for a district that you're not in.
So I want you guys who are both veteran political reporters here pulling out a bit these stories of sexual harassment and indecent exposure in the beach in that political campaign, extramarital affairs in Palm Beach County with the state senator there. And of course, just this line about where you live with a Democratic state representative, former Democratic state representative here. Put this into context for us, Dan. Politics, sex, power, not new stories at all. Are we just seeing the frequency pick up in this past week, or is there something else afoot?
I wouldn't be surprised if you see the frequency of stories like this continue to increase in that, you know, we live in an age where everybody's got a camera. We live in an age where everybody's got a video camera, and it's just right there in their pocket. So, you know, these stories, sure, happened just as much 30, 40 years ago, but you're going to see more and more you have direct evidence of them.
Mark, you agree?
Yeah, generally.
But we didn't really see social media play a role necessarily in any of these cases.
No, this is good old-fashioned, you know, news media, albeit Politico or electronic, or we have a print edition.
It's dogged reporting. It's good sourcing. It's, you know, right, in some cases using anonymous sources and then coming back.
Sure. One of the things I'd like to use as a point of departure here is that as the Tallahassee press corps is attenuated, as more newspapers pull out of Tallahassee, it is going to be harder to monitor what goes on in the state capitol, and it's more important for a lot of your daily lives than what goes on in Washington. We're talking about school funding, mm-hmm, Medicaid, mm-hmm, the way this is doled out in the state, school policy. That's done in Tallahassee. It's not done in Washington. And there's a scarecrow effect that occurs when there's a reporter in the halls of the state Senate, when there's a reporter sitting in the House press gallery or in committee. That is starting to disappear more and more, and it's going to be a problem.
Some of what we've seen, certainly with the stories in and stories, plural, that are coming out of Tallahassee, Dan, yes, dogged reporting, good sourcing, but also political adversaries using cameras and hidden devices trying to capture some bad behavior.
Yeah, you know, and a lot of that is fairly speculative right now. You know, just yesterday was the Associated Press legislative day up at the Capitol, and you saw State Senator Jack Latvala sort of say that a lot of these stories are coming out because they're trying to sort of neuter the Senate for session. And you know, look at it that way, whereas, you know, also Senator Oscar Brainin made some, mm-hmm, that it might have been former Senator Frank Artiles that was behind some of the private investigations. So it's at this point, you know, that's a lot of speculation as to whether this is sort of, you know, knife in the back stuff from other legislators.
Caputo?
Yeah, well, it is a new era. Largely, it's, I think, driven not just by the more bare knuckle nature of our politics. And notice that Miami-Dade is always at the center of these telenovelas in South Florida, but it's also the technology.
Well, Palm Beach got some in.
Yeah, that's why I expanded it to South Florida,
right?
Yeah, the technology is changing. Now you can record someone with pretty darn good resolution on your camera. Yeah. You can fit a video camera in a heavy frame of your eyeglasses, mm-hmm, your glasses that you wear. So it's easier to spy on people, and so more spying is probably happening.
Politicians and behavior here on the Florida Roundup. Mark Caputo watching Florida politics for Politico. Mark, always great to have you on the program.
Thank you for having me.
You look great today, by the way, in your television suit.
I came dressed up for radio.
That's right, exactly. Dan Sweeney also along with us. Dan, you may be in your pajamas for all we know, but the reporting is still spot on. He's a political reporter for the South Florida Sun Sentinel with us via Skype. Dan, thanks so much for your time, too.
Thank you.
All right. Still to come on our program, Cuba. It eases up on travel rules for Cuban Americans in its latest maneuver in these uneasy relations between Cuba and the United States. Let us know your thoughts. 800-743-WLRN. 800-743-9576 as the roundup continues. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening this week. It may become easier for Cuban exiles in South Florida to visit Cuba. The communist government announced last weekend Cuban citizens in the U.S. won't have to undergo a special review of their Cuban passports if they want to travel to the island. Now, the change is part practical and part political. The Cuban Foreign Minister Bruno Rodriguez said it has become more difficult to process the special stamps that Cuba required since 15 of its diplomats were expelled by the U.S. government last month. That was done in retaliation over the mysterious sonic attacks on U.S. diplomats last year in Havana. It's also the latest maneuver between the Trump administration's efforts to reverse some of the Obama-era changes toward Cuba and as Cuba prepares for a leadership change of its own after Raul Castro. So how significant are these travel changes? What do they tell us about the tone of strained relations between Cuba and America? Do they encourage you to travel to Cuba? 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. We'd love to hear your experiences. You can also tweet us at WLRN. Mimi Whitefield is along with us from the Miami Herald, from our studios in Doral, and Patrick Ottman covers Cuba for CNN with us from the Bureau in Havana. Mimi, what are these changes?
Well, the changes that were announced over the weekend are basically four. As you mentioned, this $25 fee for a stamp in people's Cuban passport has been eliminated as of January 1. And that basically just said this passport is valid, can be used to enter the country, but it was bureaucratic. Travel providers had to send those passports up to the Cuban embassy in Washington to get that stamp. Mm-hmm. So now, with only one consular officer left at the Cuban embassy in Washington, it eliminates a lot of that bureaucracy. The other changes had to do with travel by recreational boat. Cuban Americans can now enter two different ports, one in Varadero, one in Havana, Marina Hemingway. But they do have to have clearance from the U.S. Coast Guard before mm-hmm. they undertake those trips. Another big change was the Cubans said, we will welcome back Cubans who have left the island illegally. That would be rafters and so on. And they did make an exception. Anyone who had tried to flee Cuba via the Guantanamo naval base mm-hmm. were going to be exempt from this. And there was another caveat. Basically, Cubans who abandoned their posts while serving abroad.
Right. Doctors, nurses, engineers, those type of things.
Yeah. Diplomats, even people who were on a sports delegation
athletes,
abroad.
Yeah. Sure.
So they still have to wait 8 years before they are welcomed back to
when
Cuba.
When it comes to the exile community here in South Florida, who is affected?
Well, the people who need to get their Cuban passports to travel to Cuba. That's not everybody. If you came to the United States before December 31st, 1970, you don't have to travel on a Cuban
right.
passport.
Yeah. But if you came after that, then you would still need to use that passport. Patrick Ottman with CNN in Havana, let me bring you in. What do you think the impact will be on Cubans visiting the U.S.? In other words, the reverse. Instead of Cuban Americans coming back to the island, Cubans wanting to come to the United States.
Well, right now, because of this ongoing conflict over the alleged sonic attacks, which Cuba, of course, denies having anything to do with, and the U.S., U.S. officials have said that their diplomats have fallen ill, apparently the victims of some plot, the U.S. is greatly reduced the embassy here and is not providing any consular services right now. And that's really what Cubans here are talking about more than their government easing up on these restrictions is right now, if you are a Cuban and you want to go to the U.S., you have to go via a third country. You have to go and wait in line at an embassy, for instance, in Bogota, Colombia. And that's just impossible for many Cubans. And, of course, there were thousands of Cubans who thought they were about to get their visa, perhaps have been told that they were going to get their visa. Then Hurricane Irma came along and damaged the embassy here, closed it. And then with the sonic attack saga, the U.S. Embassy has essentially said that there will be no consular services. So for the immediate future, Cubans are going to be very restricted who want to travel to the U.S. and how they can do that. It's become impossible for many people.
What's happened here in the foreground with these travel changes, of course, in the background is this really high-stakes diplomacy back and forth between Washington and Havana, and the sonic attacks certainly are the latest example of that, and the mystery surrounding that. But, Mimi, let me ask you about these changes that Cuba has discussed regarding travel back to the island by Cuban Americans. Any impact on non-Cuban Americans to these changes?
Not these particular changes, but in relation to these sonic incidents, there was already a travel warning for any American traveler to Cuba. And basically the State Department said that since some of these incidents had occurred at two hotels, they weren't willing to guarantee that, American travelers who frequent these hotels wouldn't also be the subject of attacks. So that has really kind of had a chilling effect, I think, on people who are kind of on the fence about whether they wanted to travel to Cuba or not.
Patrick, has there been a noticeable impact on American tourism on the island since the State Department issued this warning?
Very much so. And you already had people, because of President Trump's change in policy and threatening to further restrict how Americans can travel to Cuba, that had slowed things down. Then you had the devastating hurricane over the summer. And then this doesn't help the mystery over these very strange incidents.
Yeah.
It certainly doesn't help. And I've been received numerous emails from Americans wondering if it's safe now. And I've lived here for 6 years and have never had any kind of problems like this. And Havana is generally considered a very safe city because there are so many police on the street and there is so much monitoring of hotels and that kind of thing. And people don't have guns and there really isn't a drug problem. So that just makes it all the more strange. But certainly for many of the U.S. diplomats who were here, they did not feel it was a safe place. And that's why the State Department pulled them and their families from Cuba. And we've seen a ripple effect that there are many, many less Americans right now, at least, than there were this time last year.
And, of course, the Trump administration also has changed some of the Obama-era easing of regulations regarding Americans traveling to Cuba. You can join our conversation here on the Florida Roundup throughout South Florida, 800-743-9576. Have you been to Cuba recently? Do you have plans to go? Have you changed plans because of stories around the sonic attack or difficulty around visas or change around travel policy, either as a Cuban-American or as an American? 800-743-WLRN, the telephone number. We'll begin with Stephanie in Boca Raton. Stephanie, thanks for holding on. You're on the radio now. Go ahead.
Hi. I just came back a week and a half ago from Havana. It's my second time there, staying at the Nacional, and the first time was on a cruise ship for the day. So free trips to Cuba, and I'm going again at the end of the month by cruise ship.
So no concern about the sonic attacks, no concern about a lack of embassy personnel to help an American should you find yourself in need of that in Havana or elsewhere?
Personally, I think it's propaganda set up by Trump, and I'm going to speak freely, or Russian influence to try and make a problem between Havana and Cuba and the United States. I've made friends there. I don't have any problem there. I get treated like I was a princess going there. It's nonsense. It's all nonsense.
Stephanie,
let
me ask you, beyond the cruise ship, when you've traveled there just as flying, have you had to change your kind of designation of the categories as the Trump administration has tweaked those definitions and changed those definitions and took away the individual person to person contact category for those American trips to Cuba?
I go on to education. I am in the dance world. And dance is very, very popular. It's almost mandatory for the girls in school to study dance in public schools there. And I've made a lot of contacts there in the dance world. I haven't had to change anything. the two stories I'm getting from the Cuban travel agencies that I deal with is that these regulations from Donald Trump have not been really enforced. And I think there's a lot of confusion about this. I met four couples, Americans, staying at my hotel that happened to take the same flight back to Florida, have been there four times without being in a group. They love it. I mean, I'm not going there for the weather. It's the same weather I have in Florida.
So, Stephanie, we got it. Thanks for sharing your experiences with us. Stephanie from Boca Raton. Mimi Whitefield with our partner, the Miami Herald. Let me put kind of a little bit of that to you and your experience and your reporting about the Trump administration's slight changes that it announced, what, back in June regarding these travel categories. Stephanie in Boca says her experience is nothing's changed.
Well, she's correct, because these new measures that Trump outlined in June haven't gone into effect yet. Mm. The regulations are still being written, and until those are issued, the Obama-era rules are still in effect. But there is a lot of confusion. People aren't aware of this, so they are a little bit fearful in some cases. I've had a lot of emails and queries from people who think that somehow they will be, you know, violating U.S. law if they travel to Cuba as individuals. Now, what could happen is, for example, if they were to undertake a trip to Cuba next week, and at some point during their trip, those travel regulations came out, and they might have a problem when they were trying to return to
if they were on the island when the policy changes.
Exactly. Yeah. Because when President Trump outlined those changes in June, he said that people were fine as long as they had made all their travel arrangements prior to his June 16th.
So it could be a retroactive statement. Action when they do come up with the rules is what you're referring to.
Gotcha. So, they could have a problem.
Patrick Ottman with CNN in Havana. You heard, you know, the relatively carefree attitude that Stephanie from Boca Raton voiced, even when it came to fewer embassy personnel from the American embassy there. It seems like maybe the State Department warning, in your estimation, for Americans may have had more of a chilling effect on American tourism in Cuba than any harsh words that the president administration has had.
Absolutely. And I've been contacted by a number of people who feel that a travel warning means they're actually not allowed to come to Cuba, which is not the case. And talking to some of the U.S. diplomats before they left, they said this is actually something that the State Department is required to do when they pull diplomats out of a country because of a security reason, which is the case here in Havana, that they are required to then let American citizens know that there is a security reason that could impact them. And we should point out that there are a number of tourists who said that they feel that they could have been impacted by the sonic attacks or reports of that. But so far, the State Department says they have no evidence that anybody but the U.S. and Canadian diplomats who were impacted, anyone other than them was actually targeted by these mysterious incidents. So while some people feel that they could have been somehow included in this, the timelines are a little bit different and some of the symptoms are a little bit different. And so far, there is no conclusive evidence, the U.S. says, that tourists were actually targeted.
Another phone call here from Delray Beach. Miriam, you are on the radio. Thanks for holding on. Go ahead.
Hi, I've been traveling to Cuba for 20 years. I'm the daughter of Cuban immigrants. I first returned to the island with my dad in June of 1998 upon his first visit since 1960. Havana, to me, and most of Cuba, which I have seen, is one of the safest places I've ever traveled to. I've ventured into 25 countries at this point, and I visited as recently as 6 days after Irma hit. I took about 350 pounds of food down for friends and family.
Did you encounter any problems given the lack of embassy support staff in Havana for Americans?
Absolutely not. And I might even say that I'm used to it. For 2 decades of travel, we haven't really had an embassy presence in Havana. So to me, nothing has really changed.
Miriam and Delray, thanks for sharing your thoughts with us. Appreciate the phone call here.
Thank you.
Finally, Patrick, I want to talk a little bit more about the sonic attacks in our final moments, both for you and for Mimi. This week, the Cuban foreign minister, Bruno Rodriguez, said the U.S. is lying about the sonic attacks. It has said that it knows nothing about it. What is the latest position from Havana on these attacks?
So they've now evolved to saying that there were no attacks. In the beginning, they said they were cooperating, they had no evidence, and that whatever cooperation that existed before has really broken down. They have allowed the FBI to come down now some four times to investigate. That's pretty unprecedented. But yesterday, while he was in Washington, D.C., Cuban Foreign Minister Bruno Rodriguez Paria said that there are no attacks, that maybe diplomats, Canadian and U.S. diplomats, had health problems, but that they were not being targeted here either by a foreign government or certainly by the Cuban government. And if you talk to U.S. officials, they don't have any doubt in their minds that something happened here that involved some kind of campaign against their diplomats to force them to leave, and that's why they did pull their staff out, because they felt that they were being consistently and relentlessly targeted by unknown people or unknown governments.
Mimi, how would you describe the relations between the State Department and the Castro government over these attacks? And we know that things have gotten chillier with the Trump administration, but even more so here, as we've had sources trying to have the State Department really have Cuba at least acknowledge these attacks, but it seems like they've retreated on that now.
Now, when the foreign minister was at the National Press Club yesterday, he said that the dispute over these attacks or incidents could further deteriorate U.S.-Cuba relations. And they're already, you know, verging on a sort of a Cold War chill.
Yeah. Right. And getting chillier. The temperature seems to be turning down, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
Yeah.
And he was very specific in his language yesterday. He said no attacks, no deliberate actions by Cuba, and that there were no specific actions that caused these health symptoms. And he said it would be impossible for a single incident to cause the variety of symptoms. So this is really the most precise Cuba has been on these incidents.
Mimi Whitefield, reporter covering Cuba, award-winning reporter covering Cuba, Latin America, for our part in the Miami Herald. Mimi, always great to have you on the program. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Tom.
Patrick Ottman also along with us. Patrick is in Havana for the CNN Bureau. Patrick, nice to have you on the radio as well. Thanks for your time.
Anytime.
We've got more to come here on the Florida Roundup. Stick with us. MSNBC's Lawrence O'Donnell will join us on the echoes of today and an election almost a half century ago and the role that Florida played in both. 800-743-WLRN is our telephone number as the Roundup continues. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening this week. So I want you to listen to this presidential candidate as he was drumming up support for his campaign in Miami.
We have decent American citizens who want to uphold our tolerant values and keep our country safe. We want to keep our country safe, folks. People who support the police, who want crime reduced and ended, and who are not prejudiced. They're concerned and loving citizens whose hearts break every time an innocent child is killed violently on the streets, which is happening all over our country.
Now, listen to this presidential hopeful making his case to American voters from a podium also in Miami.
As we look at America, we see cities enveloped in smoke and flame. We hear sirens in the night. We see Americans dying on distant battlefields abroad. We see Americans hating each other, fighting each other, killing each other at home. And as we see and hear these things, millions of Americans cry out in anguish. Did we come all this way for this?
Two Republican presidential candidates, almost 50 years apart, both using South Florida as a place to describe a country on edge and in despair. Both beat the early odds and were successful in winning the White House, Donald Trump in 2016 and Richard Nixon in 1968. Lawrence O'Donnell is the host of MSNBC's The Last Word with Lawrence O'Donnell and is author of Playing with Fire, the 1968 Election and the Transformation of American Politics. He'll be appearing at the Miami Book Fair Monday, November 13th, and joins us now. Lawrence, welcome to the program. Nice to have you on.
Great to be here, and it's going to be great to be in Miami.
We look forward to it. We promise the weather will be nice. Do you hear much difference in those two messages between candidate Trump in 2016 and then Republican nominee Nixon in 68?
No, some of the basic choruses of all Republican presidential campaigns were first established in 1968 and have just been absolutely reissued every 4 years. There are so many parallels between Nixon and Trump, but also between George Wallace and Trump, mm-hmm. and that might be actually the clearest set of precedents for Trump is that George Wallace's campaign manager last year told me that when he would listen to the Trump campaign, he was listening to Wallace, and he was listening to the Wallace campaign, and he was listening to the message that Wallace put out there aimed at exactly the same voters. And so the parallels on both sides, Democrat and Republican, from 1968 remain with us. The Democrats invented in 1968 the insurgency from the left of the party mm-hmm. against the establishment candidate.
That Eugene was McCarthy created, back that, then.
Yeah, a role created by Gene McCarthy, filled by Bernie Sanders last year.
So you've seen a lot of echoes in the 16 campaign and the 68 campaign. Do you anticipate, would you call and describe the 2016 campaign as transformative to the future of politics and where we're going, what we'll see in 2020, 2024, as the 68 campaign in tone and tenor was?
I don't believe so. I believe, and I'm prepared to be wrong about this, that Donald Trump is a unique character in our politics and a temporary character in our politics. I don't believe there is another person who can stand up on the stage and succeed in the same way doing the same things. And so and we saw that, for example, you saw everyone the Republican the Republican Party had who could conceivably have been considered a presidential candidate material. They all ran, every single one of them.
All
ran.
17 or 18 and, of them, yeah.
Yes, and you saw in Florida when Marco Rubio decided to play the Trump game and call him a con man, and which was completely true. Everything Marco Rubio said was completely true, and more true than what Donald Trump was saying. But you notice that Marco Rubio was penalized for that. He was penalized for behavior that we all would have said to you yeah. prior to 2016. Voters don't like that kind of talk.
And he was penalized in his home state, a state that he had won run election in 2010, carrying the kind of independent or the understart vote, so to speak, in the 2010 Tea Party campaign. And during the presidential primary here in Florida, he won only his home county out of 67 counties in Florida.
Yes. And so that's our little model right now that we can look at and say, does that work when someone else tries to play the Trump game? Does that work? To a certain extent, Ted Cruz tried to do it when he was still in the campaign. He tried to attack Donald Trump in these very personal terms, by the way, all of which were right. I mean, he didn't say anything when he was really going anti-Trump. There wasn't anything he was saying that wasn't right. That style was not accepted from him, even after Trump insulted and lied about Ted Cruz's father, insulted Ted yeah. Cruz's wife. Even that didn't create any sympathy among Republican voters for Ted Cruz hitting back.
Speaking with Lawrence O'Donnell, host of MSNBC's The Last Word, with Lawrence O'Donnell, author of the new book entitled Playing with Fire, the 1968 Election and the Transformation of American Politics. He will be at the Miami Book Fair on Monday, November 13th. I want to connect 68 to 16 and 17 here as we move forward. Florida played a role in that 68 election, much smaller role, certainly, because it just wasn't as populous as it is today. But it was the scene of that Republican National Convention and the ascendancy of Richard Nixon to the nomination through a brutal nomination, certainly on the Republican side. And the role of Florida has only grown on the national scale. Where is it headed, and what is that influence that you see from outside Florida?
Well, it's look, the Electoral College is the thing that makes these states powerful. And so as long as Florida remains a swing state, as long as it can go either way, it becomes a crucially important state that every candidate is going to pay a tremendous amount of attention to. Now, interestingly, in 68, on the Democratic side of the campaign, Florida didn't matter much in the primaries.
Right.
It wasn't seriously contested because neither Gene McCarthy nor Bobby Kennedy thought they could go down to Florida and be really effective, and neither one of them wanted to be perceived as failing in Florida, mm-hmm. for example. So Florida is always there in primaries, in the general election. Florida is always a puzzle part that every campaign stares at in both parties, in the primaries and in the general election, as a big and difficult prize to win. And it has remained, it has been that since 1968.
The 68 campaign also had an incumbent president who decided not to run, had a very crowded field on the Democratic side of things. We can't help but take a little bit of time here, Lawrence, and talk about the positioning for 2020 on the Democratic side, and even for that matter on the Republican side. How do you see that playing out here? As granted, we're only less than a year into the Trump administration.
So we have seen in our history exactly one incumbent president decide not to run for re-election. And actually, I should say, decide to drop out of what was already his campaign for re-election.
Yeah, President Johnson.
And he was dropping out in the lead. There was no real evidence that the nomination could have been taken away from Lyndon Johnson, given that the primary process was not as developed as it is now, and most of the delegates that you would get for the nomination were not produced through primary elections. That was a completely inside game,
right,
completely controlled by LBJ, and he could easily have had that nomination. And he was running in the polls much higher than where Donald Trump is running in the polls now. And LBJ decided that the re-election campaign wasn't worth it, that he wasn't going to put himself through it. He wasn't going to put himself through those challenges. So here you have Donald Trump, an accidental president, someone who started off running for president, not actually trying to be president, who may have even less attachment to the job than LBJ did. And no one in the world imagined that it was possible to have a stronger attachment to the job of presidency than LBJ.
Yeah.
This was a career fulfillment. This was the toughest politician in America.
Yep.
This was the politician in America best at the inside game. And here he was, quitting under pressure.
Right.
And so if we're going to see that a second time, 2020 might be that second time.
Lawrence O'Donnell, host of The Last Word with Lawrence O'Donnell at MSNBC. The new book, Playing with Fire, the 1968 Election and the Transformation of American Politics. Lawrence, thanks for your time. We'll see you in Miami at the book fair on November 13th. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Finally on the roundup real quick, West Palm Beach has a world championship. Did you know this? All right, well, it's the Houston Astros that won the World Series, but for about 6 weeks in the springtime, the Astros came to West Palm Beach for spring training. So West Palm Beach takes some credit here. After all, for 20 years, the Astros trained just outside of Orlando without producing a World Series title. So now, Houston, West Palm Beach, world champs. That'll do it for the roundup this week. It is produced by Bridget O'Brien. Our technical director is Jason Zabka. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening.